Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA podcast.
What's up, everybody? I'm Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA podcast. Today's episode is an interview that I did with a guy named Josh Scanlon, who is a financial planner and also an old hardcore guy like me. If you've paid attention to my videos, you know that I care a lot about money, but not in the way that people sometimes think. You know, I'm not greedy. I don't believe that money buys happiness. I don't even think it's especially important necessarily, as far as I certainly don't think that your life should revolve around the pursuit of money. But I do, as somebody who grew up poor, I do know that life sucks when you do not have enough money. And so that's really why I'm passionate about it. And that is what we talk about on this episode. Basically, the essentials of personal finance, how you should think about budgeting, some ways that you should and shouldn't think about investing. Disclaimer, this is not investment advice, so you can't sue us. But if you're interested in personal finance, definitely check this one out. The subject is not as dry as you might think. It's actually pretty fun once you kind of get into it, at least I think so. Excited about this one. If you're into this topic, make sure you check him out on YouTube. It is called Heritage Wealth Planning. I'll link to that in the show notes as well. Before we get into the show, really quickly, there's three things that you can do to support the show if you like it. Number one, share it on social media. The platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts and stuff don't really do much to help spread the word and help people discover the show. So when you guys share it, it really helps a lot. When you do, I would love it if you tag me, tag the guest, and tag Deanna. Number two, if you really like us, you can buy some merch. I just designed some stuff that I think is pretty cool. There's a link to that stuff in the show notes. And lastly, if you really, really like us, then you can support on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes as well. Patrons get every show a week early. There's a members-only private Discord that I'm in all the time. There's a chance to have me review your band or your podcast or your graphic design or photography or portfolio or any other thing that you might want to send my way and get my feedback on. So if that sounds cool, check that out at the link in the show notes, and let's get into the show.
First and foremost, Finn McKenty, is that old school Irish name, or what the hell kind of name is Finn McKenty, first and foremost?
I'm told it's Scottish, but I don't know. My mother is American and my father's from Norway, so I don't know how I ended up with such a weird name, but here we are.
Right on. And just tell us a little bit about Finn. You know, just start with, you said you were born in Bellingham, but just go from there. We'll get into some of this other stuff later on, but just tell us about Finn.
Yeah, so I was born in Bellingham, Washington, which is a little college town in between Seattle and Canada. Grew up in the Seattle area my whole life. After that, I moved, the whole first 18 years of my life. Moved around quite a bit after that. I ended up living in Ohio, in Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus for a total of about 12 years through just kind of, you know, the typical punk hardcore kid type of thing where you end up kind of wandering around and stumbling and making a lot of, you know, you go into it certain you got it all figured out, and then come out the other side realizing you didn't know anything about anything. But you know, that's all good. It's part of the journey. So I did that. I ended up going back to college when I was 25, got a degree in management and marketing at the University of Cincinnati, which is just a middle of the road Midwest state school, but I feel like I got a fantastic education out of it. Ended up there, you know, when I was a kid, I was really in love with music and skateboarding and graffiti and all that sort of thing. And then what I discovered when I was in school is that I actually fell in love with business. I just didn't, my family, my mom never really had much of a career. My dad was like in the Navy and then a corrections officer, and respect for that. But, neither of them knew a lot about business necessarily. You know, they were not entrepreneurial types. I learned a lot from my dad, you spend 20 years babysitting murderers in a cage and you learn a thing or two. And I'm very grateful for that. But point being, I didn't know what business was or why it was such an exciting, cool, creative challenge. You know, I look at business the same way as a painter looks at an empty canvas. I just like rub my hands together like, ooh, cool. This is going to be fun. Let's see what we can do with this. And that's really what I learned at school. And so after that, I've spent my career in kind of various creative fields. I did graphic design for a while for Abercrombie and Fitch, and then moved into a marketing role there. So I got to see kind of how I don't know if they're a Fortune 500 company, but
probably close to it, if not.
This is still in Cincinnati, or did you come back?
That's
to
in Columbus.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so I got to see how at least a giant multinational retailer does things. Went over to China to do a bunch of stuff for them, which was cool. China and Korea, Indonesia, Japan.
But you went all these places on behalf of the company.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool, man.
Yeah. Yep. Because we had factories over there. So that's what I did, is some kind of quality assurance kind of stuff for them. So again, that's the kind of like operational stuff, the scale of what a global retailer like that does. I think there's no other way to learn that other than to be part of that machine. And to be clear, I was a very small cog in that wheel. I wasn't calling the shots, but just to even see how that machine runs is super cool. Before that, I worked at a product design firm called Kaleidoscope in Cincinnati. We did industrial design and engineering. The two things I worked on there for the most part, it was mostly Procter & Gamble stuff. So I worked on Febreze and Swiffer quite a bit. This was a while ago, but even still, they don't redesign those products very often. So most of the Swiffer stuff that's on the shelf now, I had a hand in. Yeah. Again, I don't know how big those brands are now, but they were, just over the $1 billion mark at that time. And I'm sure there's several times that now Tide alone made like $10 or $12 billion then. And I'm sure it's, probably twice that now. And again, just to see scale was such a cool opportunity. Again, I'm just a tiny, tiny cog in the machine, but you think about, for example, if you add 1 millimeter of plastic to the cap on the Tide bottle and they make, probably 1 billion bottles of that a year. Think about what that means, and how many Tide plants are there? Anything you do gets multiplied by every plant across the world and location with shipping and all that other kind of stuff. And then after that, I worked for a technology company called Creative Live in Seattle. It's an online education platform for creators and entrepreneurs, mostly focused on photographers. So that was really cool. Got to learn how a venture-backed startup runs. We had some really top-notch investors like Greylock and Social Capital and Google Ventures. Got to be part of that and helped us. I've known the CEO and founder for like 20 years.
Now, were you still doing that in Columbus, or did you move?
That's in Seattle. I moved back to Seattle.
So did you move back to Seattle because of the gig, or did you say, I got to get back to the Pacific Northwest?
Yeah, I just said, I got to get out of Ohio. Much respect to Ohio, but it's not for me. I think if you're born here, I just run on a different speed. So that was cool. And then after that, I am now in my current role, which is I'm the director of operations for a company called URM Academy, which is an online education platform for music producers. Small company. There's like basically five of us that, there's some partners and then a couple contractors and stuff that kind of run the thing. And then I also do the YouTube thing, but I most people probably know me for YouTube, but to me, that's just like a fun thing I do. At the end of the day, the thing that I'm most excited about is operating. I mean, I'm an operator, a purebred operator at the end of the day.
So URM is a, go over that again. What exactly is it?
It's an online education platform for rock and metal producers. So if you want to learn how to record and mix music, we teach you how to do that. So
really?
The way it works is that every month you get the actual raw multi-track session for a retail album. This month we have Tom Lord Alge mixing Angels and Airwaves, which is Tom DeLonge from Blink-182's other band. Last month, we had a guy named Will Putney mixing Knocked Loose. Before that, some of the other bands we've had on that people might know would be like Bring Me the Horizon, Fall Out Boy, Day to Remember, that kind of thing. So you get the actual files, and then at the end of the month, the producer mixed it on the album, comes on and does a live stream where they show how they did it on the album, so you can kind of compare your work to theirs. We have a few different tiers, but the main one is $20 a month, and we've got somewhere between, we don't publicly disclose it, but somewhere between 1 and 10,000 paying members across the
Whoa.
World.
No, so if you're in a band, you could sign on URM for, let's say, $20 a month, whatever it is. You know what I'm saying? I know you got different tiers, and you could watch these guys, these professionals, do what they're doing to get the music, produce the sound good.
Exactly. So if you want to know how Periphery or whatever does it, you don't have to guess. You can just watch, and Nolly will show you exactly how.
They don't use DATs or anything anymore, I guess, or what?
No, they don't. But, sometimes we had Daniel Bergstrand come on and mix a Meshuggah song from 1995, and he had to pull that off ADATs. So, they're still floating out there.
That's crazy. So if you're in a band, I'm just saying you're in freaking Toledo, Ohio, you're saying, we got, you know, we got a local, we're good. I don't care what kind of metal or rock I get it, but I'm just saying we're, you know, we like what we're doing, but we just, we don't know what to do next. I mean, hell, they could sign up to your thing and,
Yeah, it's amazing. And before we came along, there was nothing. I sort of pioneered this a little bit at Creative Live, but before this, there was just no way for you to get your hands on these sessions unless you like knew somebody that worked at the studio or
exactly.
something like that.
Exactly.
And I mean, you know, people would have paid $1,000 for this. It's funny how people get accustomed to this stuff. You know, 10 years ago, someone would pay hundreds of dollars to get their hands on the files for this one song. And now it's $20 a month. They're like, eh.
And they're like, I don't know if it's worth it.
Yeah, so, yeah I don't know. Or I could spend $20 on 4 cups of coffee.
What this? Or to, never mind, get me started by all these people claiming they're poor and then they're getting tattoos all over the place. Like, well, tattoos right. ain't cheap, man. So let's get our priorities here. So let me ask you a question. So back in the day, you'd have to go to a studio to record. You know what I'm saying? Then the engineer, whatever, would be the guy in charge. Can you yep. literally do it in your home based studio now with just using Apple products or what? I don't care about, you know what I'm saying? Yep. You can do all that.
Absolutely. I mean, as one example of that, some people, if you're into this kind of music, you would know the band A Day to Remember. Yeah. Big band. They've got platinum albums. Their album Common Courtesy from 2013 was recorded in Jeremy and Andrew Wade lived in the same house. They recorded it in their house. I went over there. Andrew was mixing it in their spare bedroom, which is untreated, no acoustic panels or anything like that, on some Windows computer you could probably get for $1,200. Like, and that thing was a Billboard Top 10 album. There's absolutely no reason you can't do all that. There are some certain things that you would need to go to a studio for, like recording drums and stuff like that. But, you know, really, yes, you can do a pro quality album in a home studio. No question. People do it all the time. There's very few situations in which you need to go to a studio. There might be some times in which you want to for various right. reasons, but you don't need to.
Now, do most bands have drummers, or are they all just using on? And I watched the video you did on the 808s. I know I'm familiar with all that, but do most bands still have drummers, Finn, or are they?
Bands, yes. But even then, there's ways of programming drums, which are more and more common because, you know, recording drums is a pain in the butt, to make a long story short. So a lot of people choose to program the drums on the albums instead, and then, you know, they'll play them live. But
okay.
a lot of program drums on albums, or there's various different hybrid approaches, but I won't bore your audience with all the technical details on that.
Well, I noticed on one of your videos you were, you know, doing the double bass, and I just like, you hear some of these double basses, you're like, how is that humanly possible? And then you said it's literally not. And I was like, okay. Yeah. that made me feel good. I was like, there's no way this could be some guy with a double bass playing that fast.
No.
So with URM, I mean, what kind of marketing, how you get, I mean, Punk Rock NBA is obviously can't hurt, but obviously that's not your main gig. How you getting out there in front of people who are, you know, budding musicians and entrepreneurial, and they say, look, we're going to do this on our own. How you take it to the masses so they can hear about you? I mean, this is pretty awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of different options. You know, the number of marketing channels available to a small company or an entrepreneur now is amazing. And it's a thing that I think is missed in the conversation now. You know, everyone hates big tech for a lot of, you know, justifiable reasons, right. a lot of valid reasons. But the part that's missed in that conversation, the reason we exist is because we can use Facebook and Instagram ads to reach people all over the world very, very, very cost effectively. So we can get a customer for, let's call it $20.
Yeah.
And that customer becomes profitable in a month or two, you know, depending on how the lifetime value works out, blah, blah, blah. But we couldn't do that, you know, 15 years ago when you had to do print ads and direct mail and all this stuff. To spin up a direct mail campaign is tens of thousands of dollars. And what if you get it wrong?
Yeah.
You know, well, there goes your operating capital. You're out of business. The lights are out.
Literally, you're out of business because you did not get the ad right, which is...
Exactly. Exactly. And now I can spin up a Facebook campaign and like for $20, I'll get an idea of like, is this potentially going to work?
That's crazy.
And so this has enabled like this whole generation of direct-to-consumer businesses like that are now getting billion-dollar exits, like Dollar Shave Club and Warby Parker and Away and all these like direct-consumer businesses. would not exist without big tech, without Facebook and Google and Amazon in particular, because you know, Amazon Web Services enables you to start a company with a credit card and $15. You know, so you can have a company off the ground in a weekend with an AWS account, a credit card, you know, with a credit card, and then AWS, Facebook, and Instagram marketing, and you got a business in 24 hours.
It's insane. Look, I have a deep love-hate relationship with Google, but I love them more than I hate them, simply because I'm sitting there thinking, I'm getting paid on YouTube, and I'm getting paid from, using Google spreadsheets. I mean, all that stuff is free. I get, they give the information. Look, I get all that. But I'm sitting there thinking, you think back, like you said, just 10 years ago.
I mean, did somebody come to your house and put a gun to your head and force you to do any, to use
it? Exactly. What they're doing. You know, and this is why I love what you're doing, because so many people are just sitting there negative on the world. I'm like, you have so much opportunity to be who you wanted always to be, and there's nothing literally holding you back other than, I don't know what it is. You don't want to take a risk, but how much risk is it truly?
And I should preface all that by saying, this assumes, when I say all those things, it assumes you're an able-bodied person in a developed country.
Yes.
It's if you are one of these people that's unfortunate enough to get born in a literal garbage dump in the Philippines or something, pull yourself up by your bootstraps is, you know, I would never say that to that person. But if you're a kid with a smartphone in America, you know, that's able-bodied, like, I don't know what more you could possibly want from the world than that.
Well, the irony of it all is, about 25 years ago, I had a small little record label, and I had guys in Philippines and Brazil and Russia, you know, just as a distro, you know what I'm saying? Just trading CDs, trading data, the whole thing. And that was in the mid 90s, you know what I'm saying? And even back then, there's still, I completely agree with what you're saying. If you're literally in India and there's 25 kids in your home, I get all that. But for us here in a modern America, it is, as fundamentally, it's so much different and so much more liberating than it used to be. You know what?
I mean, I started doing zines in like 93, maybe.
Yeah, I heard, right?
It's and I would have to sell. I actually, looking back on it, I'm like, how did I do that? You know, I would have to somehow like market these. I didn't have a marketing budget. I didn't know what marketing was. And yet somehow I was able to sell thousands of these things through the mail to people all over the world. And so I'm 16 years old going to the post office, mailing stuff to Iceland and Singapore. And they're probably wondering, what the heck is this guy doing? But it's like, man, if we were able to do something at that scale in 1994, you put a 100x on that with all the tools you have now. It's like there's nothing stopping you.
So, but here's a question. All right, so we're not going to get too deep into our both backgrounds, but similar backgrounds. So how did we get the entrepreneurial bug by watching our parents and say, that's not what we want to do? Or are you the firstborn or what, you know?
I'm an only child.
Okay. So did we get the – I'm the firstborn. Did we get the entrepreneurial bug from being the firstborn, i.e. only child, or did we get the entrepreneurial bug? Like, what caused Finn and Josh to have this, I got to get out there and share this? You see what I'm saying? Where other people don't have that. Does that make sense what I'm asking you?
I think it is something that's born, not made. Yes. And that's not a judgment. We're all just different. I mean, my wife is not like this, and I'm glad, because that'd be a little too much. So I don't know. I think it's just a personality trait you're born with. And I think it's important for people to know who they are and to recognize, like, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole is going to cause problems. There's lots of people who are born entrepreneurs that make terrible employees. Yes. And that's a very well-known thing. Yeah. And you see those people sometimes frustrated and causing problems for themselves and the organization and all that kind of stuff. And then on the other hand, there's people who are trying to be entrepreneurs that, you know, that just are not that person. And one is not better or worse than the other. They're just different. And so to me, it goes back to like self-awareness and just understanding who you are. For me personally, I never, and I still don't necessarily think of myself as an entrepreneur or entrepreneurial person. Like, I don't really, I mean, this is doing things the hard way. I don't really want to do things this right. way. Right. Like sometimes I'm like, why am I doing this? I wish I was just one of these guys that shows up to my job at Microsoft, you know, flies under the radar, some boring job nobody cares about, like accounts payable or something, you know, collects 80 grand a year. You're not going to get rich off that, but it's a nice living and just, you know, a 9-to-5-er, because that's playing much easier. Like, why am I playing things in hard mode? But again, I just realized this is who I am. Right. I'm not that person. And it would be foolish of me to try to fit myself into that mold just because I that's what I want. You know,
did you know that's who you were though? You see what I'm saying?
Probably not until like 5 years ago, maybe. Yeah. And would have been cool if I figured that out earlier, but I didn't. And I think there's a lot of people from our scene that don't figure these things out until later in life. And you know, that just is what it is. And part of what I would like to do with my channel is help people figure these things out earlier and easier than I did, and avoid some of the painful lessons that I had to learn.
And you got kids, Finn?
No.
Okay. So your wife is.
I would like to, but not yet.
Okay. Understood.
She's 25 though, so she's got some time.
And she's working. Like my wife is the same thing. She's not. And I say risk taker because it sounds so dramatic. Like I'm a risk. I'm not like that at all. But
I think of myself as very risk averse, actually. Yeah, me too. But the risk. Here's exactly. The thing: is that lots of times, taking the conventional path is actually the riskier one, because one thing I've realized, there is no such thing as job security. Yeah. So the idea that you go work at Microsoft and that means you can coast for 30 years, fiction.
Yep.
They lay people off all the time. You get some terrible boss.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, or stuck in some bad part of the business that's going to like grind your career to a halt. And then you get laid off at 44 and you know, you're kind of flailing. The reason why I do things the way I do things is actually because I am risk averse, because I don't want anybody else to have control over my fate. I mean, ultimately, like we're all part of a system much bigger than us. I don't mean to make it sound like I have complete control over the world, because none of us do, but I don't want to place my fate in somebody else's hands. That's why I do this, because I am risk averse.
Yeah, well, the idea of, you know, that 44-year-old guy just got laid off from Microsoft. Now, he also has a big, fat mortgage he can't afford.
Yes, exactly.
That doesn't scare the crap out of you. Nothing would, that's for sure.
I mean, we live in you can see my house here. We live in a two-bedroom condo. Yeah. We could afford something twice this big easily, but we don't. Even though, you know, my wife has a great job. She works at Amazon. I'm doing well. We can afford something twice this big, but... You know, that is exactly what I see. I go past some of these houses here that are 800 grand with, you know, three $50,000 cars in the driveway. And it's just like, man, I hope for your sake, you never get laid off, never end up in that bad spot, because that is a tough nut to crack every month. Not to mention, like, what is the, you know, opportunity cost of all that money parked in, at least in the case of the cars, depreciating assets? It just makes my soul hurt.
Well, it's not even, actually, it's even worse than being laid off, because it's a threat that was sort of dangling.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
You're sitting there thinking,
limits your options too. What if you hate your job? Yeah. You can't quit because you got a $3,800 mortgage.
Man, I'm telling you, dude, that's the risk is actually hating your job, even though you're living this, what looks to be a fancy schmancy life, but you're miserable as all can be. That's actually in my channel, I talk a lot about that. I say, you know, get out of your crappy old job. You know, some people like it, that's fine. But other people say they hate it. And I say, you know, but they're worried about retirement. They're worried. I say, look, if you don't have debt, you have, the world is your oyster. But once you have these big debts, you are literally a slave to pay off those debts. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing I could teach my younger self, and I wish, man, I just tell you, it's just, I wish I would have avoided debt like the plague. And that doesn't mean you can't use it, you know, systematically and whatnot, like the AF, like you were talking about.
With don't stumble into it blindly.
And just buy a house because the guy said, well, you can afford this house. It's just sad. So let me ask you a question. So now you got the channel for the music, and then you got the kind of a relatively new channel where you're kind of helping people in terms of personal finance and stuff, or just, you know, kicking the pants kind of channel. What are you doing over
Yeah,
there?
I would just think of it as like, I think of it as like business and personal development, okay. You know, anything under that heading about like starting your own company or, you know, furthering your career if you work for someone else and all that kind of like personal finance stuff that nobody told a lot of us, you know, just any of those sort of things, like, you know, that anything I would have liked to tell myself 15 or 20 years ago.
Do you, you think a lot of these people are actually graduating with, and this seems like an odd question, but there's a method to my madness in some degree, but it's one thing to, like, you got your master, I got masters, you got a masters, and thankfully all my stuff.
I don't. I only have an undergrad degree. I'm a fake MBA.
Okay, gotcha. But do you think, I guess, how many people do you think are being sucked into the realm of they have to go to college because that's what they've been told for the last 40 years, where they're putting on their entrepreneurial hat on hold because they're like, this is what I have to do. And so now they're getting out of college with $50,000 and $60,000 debt. And they can never grasp their creativity because they have to pay off. Does that make sense what I'm asking, Finn?
It does. And that's true. But on the other hand, I just have a hard time. It's like, dude, nobody put a gun to your head and made you take the damn loan.
Yeah.
Like the terms were right there. If you didn't read it, like I took on a lot of college debt. When I graduated, I had $90,000 of debt. Ooh. But it was deliberate.
Yeah.
And it was worth it because right now I make four times what I did when I graduated from college years ago.
You knew what you're getting into.
Yeah. And part of that is because I didn't go until I was 25. However,
yes.
It's like, I just don't buy this like victim narrative of, it's like, dude, nobody forced you to take on that loan. And it's not like it's a mystery,
right?
Like, exactly. It's not like this is a secret that college, like that student debt is a thing and that it can make your life more difficult. Like, I just don't buy the victim card. That said, there are a lot of people in this system who have bad incentives. And I think a lot of that goes back to the fact that these are federally backed because it creates a moral hazard for pretty much everybody. Yeah. You know, this, why are college tuitions going up 10% a year or whatever they are?
Right.
Because why wouldn't they?
Right. They got the government to back them.
Exactly. Why wouldn't they? If the kid defaults, so what? Who cares?
And
so $80,000 for a creative writing degree? Sure, why not? Uncle Sam will foot the bill if the kid defaults. So and how do we get them to choose our school instead of the other one? We'll build some fancy new student rec center.
And put some rich guy's name on it so he can feel like he's giving back. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's all a racket, and I don't think anybody necessarily has bad intentions. It's just that, you know, what's rule number one of economics? People respond to incentives.
Yeah,
I think we've created a system that incentivizes behavior that we don't want.
But you went to I went in the Army because I was horrible at high school. You went to school at 25. I went in at 22, that 4 year for a young man, I really believe that 4 year time, the interlude between high school and college is huge for maturity. What made you say, hey, all right, I'm not like when you got to exit, you were on the you were on the newspaper in high school as well. And then you said, what's that?
And the debate team, which I loved.
Debate
is one of the best things I ever did in my life.
It seemed to me you would have been an academic, would have been a nice flow through, but in hindsight, it's glad you didn't. I'm glad I didn't. But what made you pause before you went to college?
Well, I did go for a quarter. And I got like straight D's because I just would rather go to shows and hang out. I just didn't want to be there. I wish that my parents would have like put their foot up my butt and told me like, what are you doing? But they didn't. So whatever. Can't blame them. But at least I wisely said, well, staying here would be a huge waste of money. So what's the point of spending a bunch of money? Because this is all coming out of my pocket. This is, my parents are not paying for this. You know, that's moral hazard part one right there, is all these kids whose parents are paying for this stuff and just sort of forcing them through the system, regardless of whether they're actually getting value out of it or not. But whatever. It's a whole other, we could do a whole podcast about incentives and how to align everybody's incentives, because that's a thing that I'm very passionate. It's kind of an obscure topic, but it's an important one.
Incentives drive everything, man. Everything's crazy.
They do. And like, I use that for myself. We use that for the people who work for us. I mean, just understanding like if there's things that aren't turning out the way you want them to, maybe take a step back and ask yourself, what are the incentives and where, and how can you change that? Because people do respond to incentives. It's, you know, funny how it works.
Did you ever read a book on business or a book on economics or anything where you found that, or just from experience, you know, the low points of life, you say, you know, something, you got an epiphany of some sort. How did you, cause that's 100%, I could not agree more.
I don't read books very much anymore. Okay. Just because I don't think there's very many things that are worth a book. There are some things that are, and I read a lot of those in college because one of the things I did is, well, I'm paying a lot to be here. I'm going to take full advantage of every resource that I possibly can. And I went to the library all the time. I would go every week and check out, you know, 10 books.
Yeah.
And I didn't read all of them, but I would try to read at least one or two or half of one, you know, whatever. Just get what I could out of it. I would just pick up some random book about behavioral economics or something. You know, I would just basically go to economics and business section and just pick up random books. And I read a ton of stuff there that completely changed my worldview. I did the same thing with journals, all these academic journals, because it's the only time in my life where I'm going to have access to all these obscure journals. So and I didn't understand all of it, but you know, I pick up a quantitative finance journal and read that. And I didn't understand all of it because it's really technical, but at least I understood this is how these people think.
Right.
And this is the kind of work that these people do. And I would go talk to all my professors, like they have office hours. And so like one of my professors worked for the Commodities Futures Exchange Commission in Chicago.
Right.
And so he had like really deep knowledge about how financial markets worked. And he would talk about it in class a little bit and nobody cared at all. So he could tell that nobody cared. It's this lecture class with 200 people in it. They don't care about the intricacies. But I said, hey, could I come to your office hours and ask you about this?
He's like, yes, please.
Yeah. I was like, is that okay? And he was like, yeah, people usually just come to complain about their grades. If you actually want to talk about class, that's great. So I would go there and just ask him, you know, like, well, I don't understand. Why does the SEC care about this instead of that?
Right.
Well, let me explain. They probably shouldn't, but here's why they do.
Why? See, this is my thing. How is it that you and I and many others, but not, why do we have that sense? This is my thing. Like just going back, let's go back to punk rock and hardcore for a second.
Yeah.
The first time you heard a electric guitar, you're probably like, first time I heard Black Sabbath, I was like, holy crap, where has this been? And then my first introduction to punk is when I moved to the DC area from Maine, I heard Void. It was like literally like but there's something in that brain that says, this is me. Is it nature, nurture? I mean, I've always just been intrigued. Why do people like metal versus why do people like pop? Why do people like to dive in deep into quantitative economics versus most people just want to play fantasy football? Why? It baffles my mind.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant, evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today, such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts. And new episodes come out every Monday.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
You know what I'm
saying? This is one of these days I would like to learn more about this. I had a professor that studied this, I guess the academic field, somebody who's, you can maybe correct me or someone who's listening could correct me, but my understanding is that the field, that field of study is called trait theory. It seems to be that those questions are, you know, hotly debated within that field. And I'd like to know more. I have to think that a large amount of it is physics. You know, it's like biology.
Yeah.
Because we know that in some combination of atoms, the human brain can work this way versus that way. So I have to think that some component of it is physics at the end of the day. But whatever, it just is what it is. And we don't choose who we are. And you know, to our conversation earlier, you see a lot of people. I don't know. Like, there's a girl I know who, because of her parents being who they are, like really forced her to be a mechanical, to go to school for mechanical engineering. And she was failing out, and knowing her, I'm just like, she's not stupid or anything like that. She's smart. It's just like, she is not a mechanical engineer. Like she does not want to sit there and grind through calculus and physics classes and stuff. And so she switched to fashion design or fashion merchandising. And she crushed it. And now she works at a super cool company in New York, like top of the food chain, like Fashion House in New York. So it's just a question of like, you know, her nature in this context was a failure. Her nature in this other context was a home run. So I think it's about understanding who you are and putting yourself in a situation where your nature is an asset, not a liability.
How do you find that? You see what I'm saying? Like, how does somebody, and the only reason I think this guy got four kids, you know what I'm saying? And they're all different. They're all unique. They're all, I'm telling you, man.
A lot of unexpected ways too, right?
You're like,
this one's turning out like that. Interesting. I didn't see that coming.
That's, you know, the fun. And I always, like, I'm not telling you, I just, it's always been intriguing to me. Like, why does one go that way and the other goes that way? And then the one that goes this way, who really should be going that way, this girl you're just talking about. And when she gets that way, all of a sudden it's like for her, the light goes off. She goes, I love this. This isn't work anymore. This is what I want to do. And if I have to get paid, even more power to me. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
well, I think the way you find it is to think about it, which most people don't do because we don't talk about introspection very much. And that's where hardcore comes in for me. Yeah. So for one, a big part of the way that I learned that is from my parents. So my mom was an alcoholic and she went to AA and these other programs. And so from my earliest memories, she's in these programs, reading these books and stuff, like trying to understand herself and what's broken and what's working and how to adjust it. And then my dad being a corrections officer, you know, well, he was in the Navy and then corrections officer. And so, you know, choice and consequence is the theme there. I remember, so he became a counselor later on in his career, and a counselor in a prison is not like, hey, Josh, tell me about your feelings. It's more like, okay, Josh, I see you have a parole hearing coming up in 8 months.
Right.
If you want to have your best chance, you need to take this anger management course. Right. You need to go to this job training program and make sure you don't get any more infractions for this, because I see you got a couple of those on your jacket and they're not going to like that. And then they can either say, F you, man, you're not the boss of me. I can do what I want. In which case my dad would go, okay, like you can do whatever you want. You don't have to like it. I'm just telling you, this is the way it is. And so, you know, hearing those kind of conversations, you know, again, from when I was a child, I think just sort of instilled that idea in me of like, it's up to you. You do whatever you want. You just got to live with the consequences for better or for worse. And then hardcore for me played a big role when I found Youth of Today and then later Raised Band Shelter.
Yeah.
I'm not like a Hare Krishna or anything like that. But the stuff he talked about in the Shelter lyrics, it's like very deep introspective stuff that I still really haven't heard any other band talk about.
Ray Capo, I listened to an interview he just did a couple months ago, and I'm not a Christian, and I love Youth Today growing up. I was never into Shelter, but and that whole Krishna thing with like Next Step Up and stuff is all just kind of weird to me. It's like
there's a lot of weird stuff there, but also a lot of, you know, these are people who are looking for truth.
For meaning. And I'm listening to Ray Capo, and I'm like, this guy, I was incredible. I mean, here he is. He's got 5 kids now. And he's I'm 49. He's probably a little bit older than me. And I'm like, he's still just, I was blown away by the level of positivity. And it was fantastic, man. I was like, you know, here's a guy who thinks about this introspectively, like you said, and is able to relay that to other people to think. And I thought it was fantastic, especially coming from, you know, the punkish background where a lot of people are just doing self-destructive behavior. And this guy, one thing I was going to suggest, if you ever get a chance, there's a guy, Flemlo Raps, who does What Happened to This Guy for football. You know, what happened to whatever. You might, if you ever get a chance, what happened to Dan Mahoney from No For An Answer? What happened to Ray Cat? You know what I'm saying? That might be something that'd be kind of cool to do. I'm not telling you what to do, but Flemlo, his best videos by far and away are like What Happened to Trent Richardson from University of Alabama. It's incredibly, I'm sure it takes a long time to do, but I've always wondered, like, what happened to some of these guys? You know, JR from Next Step Up, what's that guy do? I mean, it'd be obviously, you know, that's a very low niche there in terms of the view, but it might be interesting.
You never know. I mean, sometimes the stuff that I think is going to do well, you know, eats crap. And then other times the thing that I don't think anyone's going to care about gets 300,000 views. You never know.
That's my biggest view is a video I almost did not do. Cause I said, didn't I just do something like that? And I did a video, and right before I was going to publish, I think I just did something wrong. Maybe I shouldn't. And I said, screw it. Let's hit publish anyway. By far and away, that's my biggest, well, not by far away, but my biggest, it's not even a great video. It's just,
exactly. It's like the one that takes off. You're like, really? That one? Okay.
How did you end up start with your YouTube channel? Like, what made you, start doing it?
Well, you know, my game plan basically is to be wherever attention is in the current, you know, age of media. So I started doing zines in the 90s because print was what people did back then. I had some blogs in the 2000s because that's where the action was at that time. And then it became clear to me, you know, by 2015 or something like that, blogs were just dead, waste of time. I still kept doing them a little bit kind of just for fun, but then I just eventually realized, you know, if I really want to be where the action is, I got to get on YouTube. I made videos for years, so I already knew how to do the technical part of it, which is actually the easiest part of the whole thing. That's really, I just decided if I want to have attention, I need to, you know, you got to fish where the fish are, right?
Yeah. Do you have any concern like getting on? I know a lot of people, women in particular, which is too bad, but they get, you know, they don't want to get on camera. Like my wife, she will not get on camera to save her life.
I don't love it, but it's part of the deal. Yeah. Although there's people that have successful, like, do you know Company Man? Have you seen that channel?
I think I have, yeah.
So he'll do a video about like Darden restaurants or something like that, like about Red Lobster's, you know, history or something like that. I mean, they're not like fantastic, but they're good for like an audience that doesn't know much about business. But anyway, he, they're basically, you know, slideshows. He never shows his face. So you can do YouTube without ever showing your face. I chose to show my face and use my real name because I want to use this as a way for people to get to know me and to build my name and reputation. I used like a fake name before when I blogged because just because I didn't want to put myself out there. But I just decided, you know what? I'm going to go all in. And I do understand, especially for women, it really is harder because people are going to say much nastier things and they need to worry about stalkers and stuff like that, that we don't have to. And that is a true privilege. So I understand. But for me personally, I just said, you know what? I'm just going to go all in on this thing. And you know, it paid off for me. And I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity. And again, you know, to our conversation before, it's like, well, Google spent billions and billions and billions of dollars building this platform, you know, and I'm so incredibly grateful for that. I wish that I could, I mean, YouTube's not perfect. Google's not perfect in lots of ways, but I just really wish I could find some of these people and give them a hug because they built this thing that's done so much for me.
And YouTube is still operating at a loss. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, they're still.
Well, they don't break it out, so we don't know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's they should. I think that that's I think that that is a matter that their board has dropped the ball on, is they don't break out YouTube revenue separately from Google.
Really? All right. So it's just like I don't want to say an urban legend, but there's no evidence that says YouTube is literally operating at a loss.
There's no way to know.
Really?
Nope. Go read their 10K. It's not in there.
See, there you go, man. You can't, just like Abraham Lincoln says, if it's on the internet, it might not be true.
They've said certain things in the past. It was true a few years ago because they said so publicly. They've said some things recently, and if you read between the lines of some of their financial statements, it suggests that YouTube is now profitable, but nobody knows for sure outside of Google.
So if you know, print, blog, and then video, how long will video be in ascendancy or ascended, whatever it is, you know, how long do you think?
I think it will last forever. Whether it will be, you know, YouTube or not is a question, probably not. But that said, people always talk about starting a YouTube competitor and it's like, dude, do you think like you are going to hit all the same structural barriers that YouTube does? For one, like content moderation at scale is they've got 2 billion users. Content moderation at that scale is really hard. So there's a guy named Werner Vogels, who's the CTO of AWS, Amazon Web Services. And he has a good framework for this. He says that their business is governed by 3 laws, the laws of physics, the laws of economics, and the laws of the land. And those, so the laws of physics are like, how fast does light travel? For example, you know, so latency, network latency, stuff like that. The laws of economics, which is, you know, people respond to incentives and all that stuff, and that you have to be profitable. And then the law of the land, which is all the regulatory stuff like, you know, COPPA and the DMCA and GDPR and all that kind of stuff. Anybody else jumping into that pond is going to hit the same barriers because it comes down to those 3 fundamental laws. Not to mention the fact that like people forget that at the heart of YouTube or Instagram or these other things are massive data centers at a scale that nobody, there's metal at the end of that, you know, like the cloud is just a word for data centers,
right?
Like it does, you know what I mean? It doesn't live in the air,
right?
It lives in CDNs scattered around the country.
And that really takes electricity to operate, by the way, you know what I'm saying?
It's just, yeah. So it's not a matter of just saying we believe in creators.
Right.
Cool. But you still have to answer to Uncle Sam and you still have to deal with, you know, latency and, you know, building data centers.
You still have to have the data center that YouTube has been bashed on YouTube, and it actually in some ways it drives you crazy because YouTube has been wonderful for me. It's obvious as a business person, but just to learn things. I mean, hell, I was able to change my garbage disposal the other day just watching YouTube. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, and how many? And again, how many people's lives has it changed just from the fact that they looked up how to do something on YouTube, and that was the thing that unlocked some life-changing opportunity for them.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's got to be millions of people.
On top of that, I'm sitting there thinking, do you really need to, I don't know, it seems to me like some of this stuff is so over the top, like YouTube demonetized. It's like, if you remember what YouTube's business is to make YouTube money. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's not to provide you a platform, it's to make right. them money. And they're going to make money by selling advertisers to the people who pay the money, who don't want to be associated with whatever it is.
That, yes. Here's the thing people need to understand. Yeah. The giant, massive, multi-billion dollar pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, which every company, but really Facebook and Google are chasing, is all those TV dollars.
Yes.
Exactly. All the money, this brand marketing, which is people just pouring money into like TV ads that probably don't work, or at least work not very well in 2020, but there's nowhere else to spend that money. And everyone, because like, of what you just said, there's so many conditions about TV that make it the best option for these current brand advertisers. One of which is that you know that nothing that you run your ad on is going to be super bad.
Exactly.
You know, at worst, it'll be South Park. But even then, like, it's pretty easy to just say, don't run our ad after 10 p.m.
Right, exactly.
So if you are Tide or Pampers or whatever else, you know, where you have a family-friendly brand and people don't understand that if your ad shows up on some edgy video,
right?
You know, people out there don't understand that that's just programmatically generated, and that doesn't mean that Pampers believes in what this video says. So, and besides which, if you know you're the CMO or worse, some you know peon marketing manager, and then the CMO comes to you and says, my son said he saw one of our ads next to such and such. What the hell are you doing with our money? Like, you know what? Never mind. I'm just going to go back to TV.
Ben, it is so obvious to me, Finn. I'm like sitting there thinking, you can see what's happening. You know.
So at the end of the day, this is good for YouTubers because
exactly.
we create a system in which all those billions of dollars of brand marketing on YouTube, we all win.
It's crazy. I'm sitting there thinking, we want this to happen because it makes us more legitimate. Thus, there's be more. I was watching Tim Pool. He does videos.
Yep.
And he was telling, and he was saying, I thought this was incredibly informative, or whatever the word is, genius, I don't know. But he's saying he probably gets more views on his channel than CNN does.
Oh, and for sure he does. Look at the view counts of like these news. They'd be like, dude, you got 1,200 views and it's coming from like NBC News?
Or in my competition, like Vanguard and Morningstar, I get more views on Vanguard and Morningstar. But I guarantee if you look at CNN ad revenues on CNN, the cable network, versus Tim Pool on or just YouTube, CNN is dwarfing them. It doesn't take a rocket science.
Right.
YouTube's like, we need that to level off. And thus, we want to make sure idiots aren't freaking ruining the platform. I don't get why people get so upset by that. It's not censorship. It's business. Anyway. All right, so I'll let you go here in just a second. So before, just a music question. What was the first, when you first heard something, what kind of band or song or anything that says, oh, this is, where have you been all my life? Like I had said way early before, what was the first song or band that you heard me say, man, that's calling to me?
I saw Suicidal Tendencies on MTV News in 1989. They had been banned from playing in LA for 5 years or something because of like gang violence at their shows. And this was, you know, the city government or whoever decided they could play shows again. And so they had this show in the parking lot of Tower Records in LA, and MTV News covered it. And I happened to see it when I was 11 or 12 or whatever. And I didn't know what it was, but I was into it. And then I got some like birthday money or something like that and went out and bought their cassette. And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, man. It's
yeah.
And yeah, you play a little bit. You play a little guitar and drums, you said, or just guitar?
Yeah, I'm not a very good drummer, but.
Okay. But are you in a band right now or anything?
No, I'm not really interested in playing music. I recorded some of my own stuff a few years ago just to kind of learn how to record just for fun. And I do enjoy it, but it's just like, you know, there's only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
And it's just not, you know, it's just not a priority. I'm a big believer in opportunity cost. And so I'm always, you know, I'm always considering that. To me, life is one big NPV calculation. You know, that's how I see everything.
Finn, you're crazy, man. I just, this is nuts. When you, your better half, is she into the music or is she like, oh, yeah, keep that away from me?
Yeah. Yeah. She likes all of it. Pretty much all the same kind of stuff as I do.
Did you meet her like at a show or something like that? Or,
More or less, like kind of just through friends of friends in the scene.
Right, so what would you suggest? Unless, you know, most of my audience is not, you know, 25-year-old kids with skateboards, but for folks, regardless of music, but just obviously you're doing something right. You know what I'm saying? On YouTube as an entrepreneurial, risk adverse entrepreneur. I mean, I see just real quick. I think that a lot of people think this Gary V entrepreneur stuff is the way to go. And I like Gary V, but I think a lot of entrepreneurs, myself included, are very risk adverse. We say, okay, I'm definitely going to look not once, but twice before I leap. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
you want to be a row on some bean counter spreadsheet, you know, that decides when they're, whether you have a job or not, because that's all you are. They don't care about you or your family or your life or anything else. You're just a row on a spreadsheet to them. And I sure don't like the sound of that.
No, especially when you got a mortgage, for sure. But any last words for the audience here? Don't hang up yet. I want to chat real quick.
No, I'm just really great conversation. Thanks so much for having me on. And you know, for anybody that is wondering what the heck we're talking about, if you made it this far, thank you. And you know, I'll be happy to share this on my end, because I think this is the kind of stuff that, you know, the younger version of us really needed to hear.
Oh, man, right on.
All right, my friends, that does it for this episode of the podcast. If you made it this far, thank you. Thank you for listening. We sincerely appreciate each and every one of you. If you want to help the show, there's a couple things that you can do. First of all, share it on social media. If you share it, tag us, tag Finn McKenty, that's me, and tag Deanna Chapman, that's a producer. Second thing you can do, if you really, really, really love us and really want to support us, you can support us on Patreon. There's a link to that in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to this, or you can do none of that. And you can just sit at home thinking about how awesome this podcast is. That works too. Again, thank you very much to each and every one of you for listening. We sincerely appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles, The Wrath of the Buzzard, PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.